Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today, from the June 22nd, 2020 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I'll read an article about the history of riot reports. And now, from the American Chronicle section of the June 22nd, 2020 issue of the New Yorker magazine, the history of the riot report, how government commissions became alibis for inaction, by Jill Lepore. On February 14, 1965, back from a trip to Los Angeles, and a week before he was killed in New York, Malcolm X gave a speech in Detroit. "Brothers and sisters, let me tell you, I spend my time out there in the street with people, all kind of people, listening to what they have to say," he said. "And they're dissatisfied. They're disillusioned. They're fed up. They're getting to the point of frustration where they are beginning to feel, what do we have to lose?" That summer, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act. In a ceremony at the Capitol Rotunda, attended by Martin Luther King, Jr., Johnson invoked the arrival of enslaved Africans in Jamestown in 1619. "They came in darkness and they came in chains, and today we strike away the last major shackles of those fierce and ancient bonds." 5 days later, Watts was swept by violence and flames following a protest against police brutality. The authorities eventually arrested nearly 4,000 people. 34 people died. "How is it possible after all we've accomplished?" Johnson asked. "How could it be? Is the world topsy-turvy?" 2 years later, after thousands of police officers and National Guard troops blocked off 14 square miles of Newark and nearly 5,000 troops from the 82nd and the 101st Airborne were deployed to Detroit, where 7,000 people were arrested, Johnson convened a National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, chaired by Illinois' Governor Otto Kerner, Jr., and charged it with answering three questions. What happened? Why did it happen? What can be done to prevent it from happening again and again? Johnson wanted to know why black people were still protesting after Congress had finally passed landmark legislation, not only the Voting Rights Act, but also the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and a raft of anti-poverty programs. Or maybe he really didn't want to know why. When the Kerner Commission submitted its report, the president refused to acknowledge it. There's a limit to the relevance of the so-called race riots of the 1960s to the protests of the moment. But the tragedy is they're not irrelevant. Nor is the history that came before. The language changes from insurrection to uprising to the bureaucratic civil disorder. Terms used to describe everything from organized resistance to mayhem. But nearly always, they leave a bloody trail in the historical record in the form of government reports. The Kerner Report followed centuries of official and generally hysterical government inquiries into black rebellion. From The Unhinged, a journal of the proceedings and the detection of the conspiracy formed by some white people in conjunction with Negro and other slaves were burning the city of New York in America and murdering the inhabitants. In 1744, to the largely fabricated official report of the trials of sundry Negroes charged with an attempt to raise an insurrection in the state of South Carolina in 1822. The white editor of the As Told To and highly dubious The Confessions of Nat Turner, the leader of the late insurrection in the Southampton, Virginia, also an authentic account of the whole insurrection with lists of the whites who were murdered. In 1831, wrote, quote, public curiosity has been on the stretch to understand the origin and progress of this dreadful conspiracy and the motives which influences its diabolical actors. What happened? Why did it happen? What can be done to prevent it from happening again and again? After Reconstruction, Ida B. Wells, in Southern Horrors, Lynch Law in All Its Phases, which appeared in 1892, turned the genre on its head, offering a report on white mobs attacking black men, a litany of lynchings. Somebody must show that Afro-American race is more sinned against than sinning, and it seems to have fallen upon me to do so, Wells wrote in the book's preface, after a mob burned the offices of her newspaper, The Free Speech. White mob violence against black people and their homes and businesses was the far more common variety of race riot. From the first rising of the KKK after the Civil War through the second in 1915. And so, the earliest 20th century commissions charged with investigating race riots reported on the riots of white mobs, beginning with the massacre in East St. Louis, Illinois, in 1917, in which, following labor unrest, as many as 3,000 white men roamed the city, attacking, killing, and lynching black people and burning their homes. Wells wrote that as many as 150 men were killed, while police officers and National Guardsmen either looked on or joined in. Similar riots took place in 1919 in 26 cities, and the governor of Illinois appointed an interracial commission to investigate. This is a tribunal constituted to get the facts and interpret them and to find a way out, he said. The Chicago Commission on Race Relations, composed of 6 whites and 6 blacks, who engaged the work of as many as 22 whites and 15 blacks, heard nearly 200 witnesses, and in 1922 published a 700-page report with photographs, maps, and colored plates. A Study of Race Relations and a Race Riot in Chicago. It paid particular attention to racial antipathy. Many white Americans, while technically recognizing African Americans as citizens, cannot bring themselves to feel that they should participate in government as freely as other citizens. Much of the report traces how the Great Migration brought large number of blacks from the Jim Crow South to Chicago, where they faced discrimination in housing and employment, and persecution at the hands of local police and the criminal justice system. Here's an excerpt. The testimony of court officials before the commission and its investigations indicate that African Americans are more commonly arrested, subjected to police identification, and convicted than white offenders. That on similar evidence, they are generally held and convicted on more serious charges, and that they are given longer sentences. These practices and tendencies are not only unfair to African Americans, but weaken the machinery of justice, and, when taken with the greater inability of African Americans to pay fines in addition to or in lieu of terms in jail, produce misleading statistics of African American crime. Very little came of the report. In 1935, following riots in Harlem, yet another hard-working commission weighed in. This sudden breach of the public order was a result of a highly emotional situation among the African-American people of Harlem, due in large part to the nervous strain of years of unemployment and insecurity. To this must be added their deep sense of wrong through discrimination against their employment in stores, which live chiefly upon their purchases, discrimination against them in the school system and by the police, and all the evils due to dreadful overcrowding, unfair rentals, and inadequate institutional care. It is probable that their justifiable pent-up feeling that they were and are the victims of gross injustice and prejudice would sooner or later have brought about an explosion. Who was to blame? The report states, the blame belongs to a society that tolerates inadequate and often wretched housing, inadequate and inefficient schools and other public facilities, unemployment, unduly high rents, the lack of recreation grounds, discrimination in industry and public utilities against African Americans, brutality and a lack of courtesy of the police. In Detroit in 1943, after a riot left 25 blacks and 9 whites dead and led to the arrest of nearly 2,000 people, Michigan's governor appointed the commissioner of police and the attorney general to a panel that concluded, without conducting much of an investigation, that responsibility for the riots lay with black leaders, and defended the police, whom many had blamed for the violence. A separate independent commission, led by Thurgood Marshall, then chief counsel for the NAACP, conducted interviews, hired private detectives, and wrote a report titled The Gestapo in Detroit. The group called for a grand jury, arguing that, quote, much of the blood spilled in the Detroit riots is on the hands of the Detroit Police Department, end quote. No further investigation took place, and no material reforms were implemented. That's what usually happens. In a 1977 study, Commission Politics, The Processing of Racial Crisis in America, Michael Lipsky and David J. Olson reported that between 1917 and 1943, at least 21 commissions were appointed to investigate race riots. And however sincerely their members might have been interested in structural change, none of the commissions led to any. The point of a race riot commission, Lipsky and Olson argue, is for the government that appoints it to appear to be doing something, while actually doing nothing. The convulsions that led to the Kerner Commission began in Los Angeles in 1965. Between 1960 and 1964, the nation enjoyed unrivaled prosperity. But in Watts, among the poorest neighborhoods of L.A., one in three men had no work. In Los Angeles, as Mike Davis and John Wiener write in his new book, Set the Night on Fire, L.A. in the 60s, the LAPD operated the nation's most successful negative employment scheme. Police stopped black men for little or no reason, and if they talked back, they got arrested. Left with an arrest record, they became unemployable. On August 11th, 1965, a Wednesday, a motorcycle cop pulled over a car with a driver and a passenger, two brothers, Ronald and Marquette Fry, about a block from their house, near 116th Street. Their mother, Raina, all of 5 feet tall, came over. Marquette resisted handcuffs. He would strike those fierce and ancient shackles. The motorcycle cop called for backup. 26 police vehicles raced to the scene, sirens screaming. "Does it take all these people to arrest three people?" an onlooker asked. When Raina Fry tried to stop the police from beating her sons with billy clubs, they pinned her to the hood of a patrol car and, after a crowd had gathered, arrested another of her sons and dragged away a woman in a stranglehold. "Damn, they never treat a white woman like that," someone called out. The crowd protested and grew and protested and grew. What came to be known as the Watts Riot lasted for 6 days and spread across nearly 50 square miles. On Friday night, a man said, "I was standing in a phone booth watching. A little kid came by carrying a lamp he had taken out of a store. Maybe he was about 12. He was with his mother. I remember him saying, 'Don't run, Mommy. They said we could take the stuff because they're going to burn the store anyway.' Then, suddenly, about 5 police cars stopped. There were about 20 cops in them, and they all got out. One came up to the booth I was standing in. The cop hit me on the leg with his club. 'Get out of here, N-word,' he yelled at me. I got out of the booth. Another cop ran up to the boy and hit him in the head with the butt of a shotgun. The kid dropped like a stone. The lamp crashed on the sidewalk. I ran out of the phone booth and grabbed the cop by the arm. I was trying to stop him from beating the boy. Two cops jumped on my back. Others struck the boy with their clubs. They beat that little kid's face to a bloody pulp. His mother and some others took him away. That's when I thought, white people are animals. Johnson could barely speak about what was happening in Watts. An aide said, he refused to look at the cable from Los Angeles describing the situation. He refused to take the calls from the generals who were requesting government planes to fly in the National Guard. We needed decisions from him, but he simply wouldn't respond. The same Friday, the National Guard arrived. More Americans died fighting in Watts Saturday night than in Vietnam that day, an observer wrote. On Sunday, 15 police officers fired 11 shotgun rounds into Aubrey Griffith inside his own house, where he and his wife had been in bed with their son, on leave from the airport, and were watching TV. The officers banged on the door, and Griffith told his wife to call the police. An inquest ruled his death and every other death at the hands of the National Guard or the police during that days of protest a justifiable homicide. Martin Luther King Jr. arrived on Tuesday. All we want is jobs, a man said to him at a community meeting in Watts. We get jobs, we don't bother nobody. We get no jobs, we'll tear up L.A., period. Later, King recalled that one man told him, we won. King had replied, what do you mean we won? 30-some people dead? All but two are African Americans? You've destroyed your own. What do you mean we won? The man said, we made them pay attention to us. Paying attention at that point only ever really took this form. The governor appointed a commission, this time headed by John A. McCone, a lavishly wealthy and well-connected California industrialist who, in 1961, had been made director of the CIA by President Kennedy, but had resigned in April 1965, in part because he objected to Johnson's reluctance to engage in a wider war in Vietnam. The McCone Commission report, titled Violence in the City, celebrated the City of Angels. A African-American in Los Angeles has long been able to sit where he wants in a bus or a movie house, to shop where he wishes, to vote, and to use public facilities without discrimination. The opportunity to succeed is probably unequaled in any other American city. It called for the creation of 50,000 new jobs, but first, quote, attitudinal training, end quote. It blamed the riots on outside agitators and civil rights activists. Although the commission received much thoughtful and constructive testimony from African-American witnesses, we also heard statements of the most extreme and emotional nature. For the most part, our study fails to support, and indeed the evidence disproves, most of the statements made by the extremists. Fundamental to the McCone thesis was the claim that peaceful demonstrations produce violent riots and should be discouraged. In a devastating rebuttal, Bayard Rustin laid this argument to waste by writing, it would be hard to frame a more insidiously equivocal statement of the African-American grievance concerning law enforcement during a period that included the release of the suspects in the murder of three civil rights workers in Mississippi, the failure to obtain convictions against the suspected murderers of Medgar Evers and Mrs. Violet Liuzzo, and the police violence in Selma, Alabama. And surely it would have been more to the point to mention that throughout the nation, African-American demonstrations have almost invariably been nonviolent, and that the major influence on the African-American community of the civil rights movement has been the strategy of discipline and dignity. By the summer of 1967, when protests against police brutality had led to riots in Newark and Detroit, Johnson was facing a conservative backlash against his Great Society programs, and especially against the Fair Housing Act, which was introduced in Congress in 1966. He'd also been trying to gain passage of a rat extermination act to get rid of urban infestations. Republicans called it the Civil Rats Bill. Johnson had long since lost the right. Now he was losing the left. By April, King had come out against the war in Vietnam. Beleaguered and defensive, Johnson launched an optimism campaign in an effort to convince the public that the U.S. was winning the war in Vietnam. George Romney, the Republican governor of Michigan, who was expected to run against Johnson in 1968, asked for federal troops to be sent to Detroit, which would be the first time since FDR sent them in 1943. Johnson wavered. "I'm concerned about the charge that we cannot kill enough people in Vietnam, so we go out and shoot civilians in Detroit," he said. In the end, he decided to authorize the troops and to blame Romney, announcing on television that there was a, quote, "undisputed evidence that Governor Romney of Michigan and the local officials in Detroit have been unable to bring the situation under control." 2,700 Army paratroopers were deployed to Detroit, with Huey helicopters that most Americans had seen only in TV coverage of the war in Vietnam. On July 27, 1967, Johnson gave a televised speech on civil disorders, announcing his decision to form a national commission to investigate race riots. Protests had taken place and turned violent in more than 150 cities that summer, and they were being televised. Were they part of a conspiracy? Johnson suspected so, even though his advisors told him that he was wrong. "I don't want to foreclose a conspiracy theory now," he said. "Keep that door open." Johnson loved presidential commissions. People called him, not affectionately, the Great Commissioner. In the first decade after the Second World War, U.S. presidents appointed an average of 1.5 commissions a year. Johnson appointed 20. In Separate and Unequal, The Kerner Commission and the Unraveling of American Liberalism, published in 2018, Stephen M. Gillen observes that commissions became a convenient way for presidents to fill the gap between what they could deliver and what was expected of them. To his new commission, Johnson appointed a Noah's Ark of commissioners, 2 by 2, 2 congressmen, 1 Republican, 1 Democrat, 1 business leader, 1 labor leader, Roy Wilkins, the executive director of the NAACP, was, with Edward Brooke, a Republican senator from Massachusetts, 1 of 2 African Americans. The commission included no political radicals, no protesters, and no young people. The president expected the commission to defend his legislative accomplishments and agenda, and to endorse his decision to send the National Guard to Detroit. When he called Fred Harris, the 36-year-old Oklahoma senator, to discuss the appointment, he told Harris to remember that he was a Johnson man. Otherwise, Johnson said, "I'll take my knife out of my pocket and cut your penis off." Nearly as soon as he convened the commission, Johnson regretted it and pulled its funding. Otto Kerner, born in Chicago in 1908, went to Brown and then Northwestern for law school, and in the 1930s and into the Second World War, served in the Illinois National Guard for 20 years, retiring in 1954 with the rank of Major General. Under his leadership, as Bill Barnhart and Gene Schlickman report in their biography, the Illinois Guard had the highest percentage of African Americans in the nation. A former district attorney, later elected to a county judgeship, Kerner had a reputation for strict personal integrity, earning him the nickname Mr. Clean. He was elected governor of Illinois in 1960, and it is possible that his coattails delivered the state to John F. Kennedy in one of the closest presidential races in American history. He had a strong record on civil rights and was an adamant supporter of fair housing, declaring in 1968, "Civil disorders will still be the order of the day unless we create a society of equal justice." After Kerner got the call from Johnson, he announced, "Tomorrow, I go to Washington to help organize this group of citizens for the saddest mission that any of us in our careers have been asked to pursue. Why one American assaults another? Why violence is inflicted on people of our cities? Why the march to an ideal America has been interrupted by bloodshed and destruction? We are being asked, in a broad sense, to probe into the soul of America." Kerner wanted open hearings. "My concern all the time about this commission has been that at the conclusion, our greatest problem is going to be to educate the whites rather than the blacks," he said. Kerner did not prevail on this point. J. Edgar Hoover testified on the first day to say that the FBI had found no evidence of a conspiracy behind the riots and that he thought one good remedy for violence would be better gun laws. "You have to license your dog," he said. "Why not your gun?" Martin Luther King told the commission, "People who are completely devoid of hope don't riot." Maybe the most painful testimony came from Kenneth B. Clark, the African-American psychologist at the City College of New York, whose research on inequality had been pivotal to the Supreme Court's decision in Brown v. Board of Education. He told the commission the following. "I read the report of the 1919 riot in Chicago, and it is as if I were reading the report of the investigating committee on the Harlem riot of 1935, the report of the investigating committee on the Harlem riot of 1943, the report of the McCone Commission on the Watts riot. I must again in candor say to you members of this commission, it is kind of Alice in Wonderland, with the same moving picture reshown over and over again, the same analysis, the same recommendations, and the same inaction. The historical trail is blood spilled in a deeply rutted road." John V. Lindsay, the handsome liberal mayor of New York, who served as the vice chair of the commission, got most of the media attention. But Kerner did his work. When the commission traveled, Kerner went out on the street to talk to people. He went for a walk in Newark and stopped to speak to a group around the corner from Prince Street. They told him they had three concerns: police brutality, unemployment, and the lack of a relocation program for displaced workers. One man told the governor that he hadn't had a job in 8 years. After months of hearings and meetings, the commission began assembling its report. Kerner wanted it to be moving and beautifully written. John Hersey was asked to write it, perhaps in the style of Hiroshima. Hersey said no. Instead, much of the report was drafted by the commission's executive director, David Ginsburg, who later helped write Hubert Humphrey's campaign platform. Toward the end of the commission's deliberations, Roy Wilkins offered emotional personal testimony that greatly informed a draft by Lindsay, describing two societies, one black, one white. Another draft contained a passage that was later stricken. It states, "Past efforts have not carried the commitment, will, or resources needed to eliminate the attitudes and practices that have maintained racism as a major force in our society. Only the dedication of every citizen can generate a single American identity and a single American community." Every word of the report was read aloud, and every word was unanimously agreed on. The final draft did include this passage, quote, "Race prejudice has shaped our history decisively. It now threatens to affect our future. White racism is essentially responsible for the explosive mixture which has been accumulating in our cities since the end of World War II. End quote. In the final report, as the historian Julian Zelizer writes in an introduction to a 2016 edition, no institution received more scrutiny than the police. That's been true of every one of those reports since 1970. Johnson, when he got the report, was so mad that he refused to sign the letters thanking the commissioners for their service. "I'd be a hypocrite," he said. "Just file them or get rid of them." The Kerner Report was published on March 1, 1968. But first it was leaked, probably by Ginsburg, to the Washington Post, which ran a story with the headline, "Chief Blame for Riots Put on White Racism." It became an overnight bestseller. It sold more copies than the Warren Commission report, 750,000 copies in the first 2 weeks alone. Released in a paperback edition by Bantam, it was said to be the fastest-selling book since Valley of the Dolls. Civil rights activists expecting a whitewash were stunned. "It's the first time whites have said we're racist," the head of CORE, C-O-R-E, declared. Republicans rejected it. "One of the major weaknesses of the president's commission is that it, in effect, blames everybody for the riots except the perpetrators of the riots," Nixon said from the campaign trail. "I think this talk tends to divide people, to build a wall between people." Conservatives deemed it absurd. "What caused the riots," William F. Buckley, Jr. wrote, "isn't segregation or poverty or frustration. What caused them is a psychological disorder which is tearing at the ethos of our society as a result of boredom, self-hatred, and the arrogant contention that all of our shortcomings are the result of other people's aggressions upon us." Johnson came up with his own explanation for what had happened in America during his presidency. "I've moved the African American from D+ to C-. He's still nowhere. He knows it, and that's why he's out on the streets. Hell, I'd be there, too." In 1969, Harry McPherson, Johnson's chief speechwriter, tried to explain what had so bothered Johnson about the Kerner Report. "It hurt his pride," McPherson said, "because it made clear that Johnson had not somehow saved the African American. But there was a bigger, sounder reason, he believed. The only thing that any hope for the African-American was a continuation of the coalition between labor, African-Americans, intellectuals, big city bosses, and political machines, and some of the urban poor. In other words, it required keeping the Polacks who work on the line at the River Rouge and the ballpark and supporting Walter Reuther and the government as they try to spend money on blacks. Middle-class whites didn't give a damn," he thought, "but blacks needed poor and working-class whites on their side." Then a presidential commission is formed and goes out and comes back, and what does it say? Who's responsible for the riots? "The other members of the coalition. They did it. Those racists." And thereupon the coalition says, "We'll go out and find ourselves a guy like George Wallace or Richard Nixon." That spring, Martin Luther King Jr. was killed, and then Robert F. Kennedy. In July, 5 months after the release of the report, Kerner wrote his own reflections, looking back at the response to the maelstrom that had followed King's assassination and arguing against the militarization of the police. "Armored vehicles, automatic weapons, and armor-piercing machine guns are for use against an enemy and not a lawbreaker. If you come out with a show of force, you, in a sense, challenge the other side to meet you. Force begets force," Kerner said. Still, Johnson fulfilled Kerner's wish to be appointed to the federal bench. During Kerner's confirmation hearings, he was questioned by Strom Thurmond about his conclusions, about the conclusions of the report that bore his name. Thurmond: Why do you say white racism caused these riots? I beg your pardon? Why do you want to blame the white people for this trouble? Kerner, because we say this has developed over a period of time, and the people in the African-American ghettos indicated that the rebellion was against the white establishment. Thurman, what does that term mean? What did you think it meant when you put it in their report or approved of it? Kerner, I thought it meant this, that over a period of years, the African-American was kept within a certain area economically and geographically, and he was not allowed to come out of it. In 1971, Kerner became involved in a scandal connected with his ownership of a stock in a racetrack. He was eventually charged and convicted of mail fraud. Sentenced to 3 years in prison, Kerner went to the Federal Correctional Institution, a minimum security prison in Fayette County, Kentucky, on July 29, 1974, 2 weeks before Nixon resigned. He insisted that his conviction was one of Nixon's dirty tricks. Quote, I have reason to believe I was one of the victims of this overall plan, he wrote. He suspected Nixon of punishing him for his role in Kennedy's victory in 1960. In his cell, Kerner kept a journal. So frequently I sit here alone, he wrote, thinking thoughts that inmates have thought since the beginning of prisons. He wrote, I wonder of what use is our prison system, as I have often wondered when I was seeking an alternative to this inhuman manner of restraining those who have violated the law. The waste of manpower, both by the restrainers and the one restrained. Removing the individual from the outside world really accomplishes nothing of a positive nature. The restraint builds up frustrations and a smothering of the will. It kills motivation and completely removes decision ability. With an ailing heart and what soon was discovered to be lung cancer, Kerner was paroled after serving 7 months. He spent what time he had left urging prison reform. He died in 1976. Not long before his death, asked about the Kerner report, he said, the basis for the report, I think, is as valid today as the day we sent it to the government printing office. And now, from the June 1st, 2020 edition of the New Yorker magazine, from the critics section, The Big Heine, How Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig Brought Stardom to America's Pastime, by Louis Menand. Professional sports right now is a COVID-19 ghost town. The games have vanished. There are a few events to cover and almost nothing to broadcast. Yet, eerily, the industry lives on. Reporters file stories and analysts hold forth even though the stadiums are empty. Athletes are paid even though they are sitting around the house. A chunk of your cable bill is going to Major League Baseball even though there are no Major League Baseball games to watch. Major League Baseball is selling Mookie Betts Dodgers jerseys, and the NFL is selling Tom Brady Buccaneers jerseys, even though no one knows when they will ever play for those teams. In Las Vegas, you can get 3-1 odds on the Yankees to win the World Series. It's a reminder that the industry is much bigger than the games and, in a sense, only minimally needs them. Sports sell newspapers, television shows, websites, as-told-to books, and exercise regimens. Professional athletes make endorsements, get paid for appearances, take part in movies, license their names to video games, and have their own product lines. The stars at the very top of their sports make more money from these things than they do from competing. And of course, there's the gambling. The idea of games in empty arenas is not as far-fetched as it sounds. As long as you have stars and scores, you have an industry. Hot dog vendors and parking lot attendants will be out of work, but most of the business can go on. The rise of sports as big business and the handling of athletes as human capital are often dated to 1960, the year Mark McCormick founded the International Management Group with Arnold Palmer as his first client. McCormick saw that in sports, as in Hollywood, it's the stars that sell the product, and he turned athletic success and good publicity into dollars. Thanks to television, the number of available dollars for the clients of sports agents mushroomed. But the possibilities had been glimpsed and the opportunities realized almost 40 years earlier by a man named Christy Walsh. Walsh was born in St. Louis in 1891 and went to college in Los Angeles. He bounced around a little, worked as a sports cartoonist and a ghostwriter, but it was his background in advertising and publicity for automobile companies that prepared him to become the first sports agent in the modern mold. He wasn't just a promoter or a handler, but someone who took charge of an athlete's complete on-field and off-field package, who controlled the publicity as well as the contracts. He signed his first client in 1921, and that client turned out to be the greatest sports figure of his day, or possibly, with the exception of Muhammad Ali, of any day, Babe Ruth. Ruth didn't just do what every ball player did, but better. On the field and off, he was in a class by himself. Walsh began working for Ruth just as advertising was joining forces with the new Science of Public Relations, a union that produced the entertainment media merchandising combine that supplies much of the content for contemporary American culture. Walsh understood how that synergy worked, how the entertainment feeds the media and the media feeds the sales. Stories in the paper about Babe Ruth visiting an orphanage, say, are good for the Babe Ruth brand. They raise the value of Ruth's next endorsement deal. But stories about Babe Ruth also sell newspapers, which then can sell more advertising space. It's in everyone's interest, including the orphanages, to make Ruth a magnet for public eyeballs. All Ruth has to do is keep hitting home runs and winning championships. The agent takes care of the rest. This multiplier effect is why the stars' incomes keep rising exponentially, why Tiger Woods, who has made about $120 million in prize money, is said to be worth close to $1 billion. Everyone in the combine wants Tiger to continue to make money so they can continue to make money off Tiger. As several writers, including Jane Levy in The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created, published in 2018, and Thomas Barthel in Babe Ruth and the Creation of the Celebrity Athlete, also published in 2018, have explained, Ruth seems to have been the first athlete to leverage his success in this way, to make more money off the field than on it. By 1926, his 12th year in the major leagues, Ruth's salary was $52,000, far more than any other ball player's, but he made at least twice that much in outside income. Shortly after ending the World Series that year by being tagged out trying to steal second base, he went on a 12-week vaudeville tour for which he was paid $100,000. It's no coincidence that the decade in which this entertainment media merchandising combine developed is known as the golden age of American sports. When writers use that term, they are not talking only about the games. They are talking about the stars, people like Ruth, Red Grange, Bobby Jones, Johnny Weissmuller, Jack Dempsey, Bill Tilden, Helen Mills, Gertrude Ederle. They dominated their sports. They set records, and the combine loves records. Christy Walsh did not invent celebrity product endorsements and appearance fees. Before Ruth met Walsh, he had already endorsed a brand of baseball bat and of cigars and a children's book, The Home Run King, or How Pep Pinder Won His Title, had been published under his name. Walsh simply widened the stream. he arranged for Ruth to act in vaudeville and movies. He put Ruth and some of his teammates on barnstorming tours, playing exhibition games around the country. Each year, Ruth was paid to play from 50 to 100 off-season games. Ruth's endorsement appeared on more than 100 products, including Quaker Oats and All-America underwear. The Baby Ruth candy bar was marketed without Ruth's consent. Ruth sued, but the courts backed the candy maker. His face was on the cover of magazines from Time and Vanity Fair to Hardware, Age, and Popular Science. In 1934, when the Associated Press ranked the most photographed people in the world, Ruth was number one ahead of FDR, the Prince of Wales, and Adolf Hitler. Walsh's first deal for Ruth was a newspaper column, though the star never wrote or likely even read a word of it. Ruth's ghostwriters were usually reporters who traveled with the team, hung out with Ruth, and picked up enough odds and ends, Ruth telling the story of his most recent home run, for instance, to turn out a weekly column. And the money was good. In the first year, after Walsh and the writers had taken their cuts, Ruth made $15,000. Walsh went on to create a stable of more than 30 ghostwriters who produced columns under the bylines of athletes such as Ty Cobb, Dizzy Dean, Walter Johnson, and Rogers Hornsby. Among them was a 24-year-old first baseman named Lou Gehrig. Gehrig's name will forever be linked with Ruth's. They were the best hitters on the best team in baseball, the New York Yankees. Between 1920, the year Ruth started playing for the Yankees after being sold to the team by the owner of the Boston Red Sox, and 1938, Gehrig's last full season, the Yankees won 10 American League pennants and 7 World Series. Ruth also won 2 championships as a pitcher for the Red Sox, setting a series record of 29 and two-thirds consecutive scoreless innings, which would not be broken until 1961. The 1927 Yankees have been called the greatest team in baseball history. With Ruth hitting third and a Gehrig cleanup, the Yankees won 110 games and lost only 44. Ruth batted .356 and hit 60 home runs, a single-season record that lasted for 34 years and has been surpassed by only 4 men, 3 of whom are widely believed to have been jacked up on steroids. Gehrig hit .373 with 47 home runs and 173 runs batted in, a record for RBIs at the time, and not an easy thing to do when the man ahead of you hits 60 home runs. In the World Series, the Yankees beat the Pirates in 4 straight. Ruth and Gehrig were polar opposites. Ruth was all flamboyance and swagger. He bought expensive cars and wrecked them. He wore raccoon coats and smoked big cigars. He gambled and caroused. His annual contract negotiations were big news. He was famous to the public for his appetite for food and drink, and he was famous to his teammates for his appetite for sex. He made no secret of it. On road trips, Ruth would be out all night partying, getting back to the hotel at dawn. It had no effect on his play. The Babe was always doing something, Marshall Hunt, a reporter who covered Ruth year-round for the Daily News, recalled. Perpetual motion. I don't think I ever saw him sitting around. The key to Babe Ruth, though, was this. Everybody loved him. God, we liked that big SOB, Wade Hoyt, the ace of the 1927 Yankees team, said. He was a constant source of joy. Everybody respected Lou Gehrig. They did not love him. He was good-natured, but distant. He had a distinctly un-jazz-age persona. This sturdy and serious lad takes copybook maxims as his guide in life and lives up to them, a Times columnist wrote after the Yankees won the series in 1927. Strive and succeed, early to bed and early to rise. If at first you don't succeed, try again. Labor conquers everything. And all the rest of them. Until 1933, when he turned 30, Gehrig lived with his parents. He brought his mother to spring training. When the team was on the road, he would leave the hotel after dark and walk the streets by himself so his teammates would think he had plans. He usually signed whatever contract the Yankees sent him. In 1927, the year he was the American League MVP, his salary was $8,000. The following year, it was raised to $25,000. Ruth was making $70,000. In short, Gehrig was a Golden Age anomaly. In 1929, the New Yorker ran a profile of him with the interesting title, Little Heine. Lou Gehrig, it began, has accidentally got himself into a class with Babe Ruth and Dempsey and other beetle-browed, self-conscious sluggers who are the heroes of our nation. This is ridiculous. He is not fitted in any way to have a public. The reporter asked Gehrig if he planned to get married. My mother makes a home comfortable enough for me, he said. Unlike Ruth and Dempsey and the rest of the Golden Age stars, Gehrig did not want attention, and this was because, unlike the others, he did not need attention. He stayed in his lane. He liked being boring. From the perspective of today's sports business model, nothing is more peculiar than pre-war baseball's inability to grasp the financial potential of broadcasting. Some teams broadcast home games on local radio stations, but the stations did not pay a fee. In most cases, anyone with a radio license could sit in the stands and broadcast a game. It was not until 1936, a year after Ruth retired, that there was an American League policy of charging for broadcasting rights. Radio turned out to increase attendance, too, especially in places where fans living in rural areas followed the games on the radio, and were sometimes motivated to drive 200 miles to a city to watch a game. Still, none of the New York teams, the Yankees, the Giants, or the Dodgers, broadcast home games until 1939. That was the year Gehrig retired. In a way, it was his retirement, not his play, not even his streak, that made him an icon. I have one true friend, Gehrig says in one of the GOAT's written columns, my mother. She is now and will always be the greatest pal I have ever had. She certainly made every effort. Jonathan Eig, in his biography of Gehrig, Luckiest Man, published in 2005, says that Christina Gehrig systematically wrecked all of Gehrig's nascent romances, once going to a woman's hometown to dig up dirt on her. In 1932, when the Yankees were playing World Series games in Chicago, Lou became interested in Eleanor Twitchell, a socially active 28-year-old with a sense of fashion. Not Mrs. Gehrig's types. They began dating the following spring and were married in September. Eleanor Gehrig changed her husband's life. She freed him from his mother's house. She took him to the ballet and the opera. A favorite was Tristan und Isolde, at which she says he wept because, of course, he understood the words. And she called on Christy Walsh to do promotional work. Walsh got Gehrig to do ads for Camel Cigarettes and Aqua Velva. Gehrig was the first athlete to have his face on a Wheaties box. A frank woman, Eleanor Gehrig left a memoir, My Luke and I, which includes, along with other uncensored remembrances, a portrait of Christina Gehrig and what it was like to live in her house. It tells us a lot more about Lou Gehrig than his own memoir does. Here's an excerpt. Built something like a lady wrestler with yellowish-gray hair snatched back in a bun. No hairdresser for her, certainly no makeup. Not that it would have mattered anyway since she was in the state of steaming, perpetual motion, no idle hands, chores around the clock, a huge breakfast prepared for her husband and son, and then an attack on the sink full of dishes. Then an almost compulsive session with the vegetables and meat for the night's dinner. Finally, she would jam a hat on her head and leave for Yankee Stadium with Lou in time for batting practice. Afterwards, back in the kitchen while Pop walked the dogs again and the parrot kept shouting baseball lingo until he was covered for the night. And at last, the evening meal, starting with caviar on toast, thick soup, a Caesar salad, meat, potatoes, the vegetables, oversized dessert, the whole works. In the backwash of this way of life, several maids came and went as members of the cast. They simply got in the way of the steamroller. After dinner and the dishes, we would settle in the living room. Mom would grab either the crochet or knitting bag and get her fingers flying, uttering sage little philosophies like, what goes up must come down, and Pop would invariably nod in agreement. Gehrig's body began to fail him in 1938. He played in all 157 games that season, keeping his consecutive game streak alive, and the Yankees won the World Series. But his hitting dropped off. By the following spring, it was clear that he could no longer play, and on May 2, 1939, the streak ended. He flew to Minnesota and entered the Mayo Clinic, where he was diagnosed with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, soon known as Lou Gehrig's disease. It seems in Ige's account that the doctor never told Gehrig outright that ALS is incurable. But athletes know their bodies, and he must have understood fairly soon that this was the end. He died like a great clock winding down, Eleanor said in 1941. He was 37. Before he died, Gehrig had, at last, his Ruthian moment. That was the speech he gave at Yankee Stadium on July 4, 1939, Lou Gehrig Appreciation Day, his farewell to baseball. By then, everyone had heard the news. Tributes were spoken, gifts were presented, Ruth was there. Said some words, put his arm around Gehrig for the cameras. Gehrig desperately wanted not to have to speak. This was exactly the kind of attention he had spent his life trying to avoid. The announcer told the crowd that Gehrig was too moved to say anything, but a chant went up, and so he walked to the microphone. Eleanor later said that he had written an outline just in case. He clearly had some sentences memorized. Amazingly, only four of those sentences have been recorded and survive. Versions of the whole speech that you read have been pieced together from newspaper stories. But we do have Gehrig's voice at the start. "For the past 2 weeks, you've been reading about a bad break," he says. "Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth." And at the end, "I might have been given a bad break, but I've got an awful lot to live for." There's nothing self-pitying in the speech, no self-denial, no defiance. He is helping other people get through his pain. This was not colorless or boring. This was a man looking at death. In the age of showmen, in the very house that Ruth built, it was a transcendent moment of selflessness. Well, that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed listening to the broadcast as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.